Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us for MitoAction's podcast, Energy in Action. I'm Kyra Mann, CEO of MitoAction, and I'm your host. Here on Energy in Action, we talk all things Mito, and I'm glad you're here to learn and be part of our community. I'm honored to have here today to talk with us Ari and Stacy Goldberg, who are going to share the story about their incredible Mito Warrior, Rena. Welcome, Ari and Stacy.
Thank you for having us.
Glad you're here. So if we can start off, I want to have you all just share about Rena's journey with Mito and when she first started having symptoms and what that diagnostic journey was about. And then we'll end talking about the incredible production of the magic bracelet and the legacy that she has left for the entire world. So do you want to just kick us off and tell us about Rena's journey with Mito?
Sure. This is Stacy, Rena's mom. Rena, from the time she was born, she had medical difficulties that baffled everybody, and none of her doctors knew what to do with it. And there were all these odd things, really weird, odd things that happened. Things like having fever every day in the middle of the day, having what seemed like developmental delays.
Low tone.
Low muscle tone.
One of the strangest was that she couldn't walk, when she would walk long distances, her legs would all of a sudden turn beet red.
And she would get very, very tired. She wasn't able to really to walk much of a distance. She got originally misdiagnosed with abnormal cerebral palsy. We went to Chopper in Philadelphia, and the doctors there wanted us to be tested for familial dysautonomia, which is a Jewish genetic disorder of if you were of Eastern European descent, and they were pretty defiant that that's what they thought it was. And we had sort of more questions than answers. We were very fortunate that we lived on the East Coast, and that by that point, they were able to test also genetically for that test.
And as opposed to Mito, familial dysautonomia has a very black and white, you know, genetic test. You have it or you don't have it. It's, you know, the gold standard. And they tested Rena once, came out negative. They were convinced it had to be a false negative because they're like, you know, familial dysautonomia just checks all the boxes. So they tested a second time.
And it came back negative. And then they still insisted. So I say fortunate for the East Coast because at that time she's now retired, but Dr. Felicia Axelrod, who was the world expert in familial dysautonomia, was in NYU in New York in the hospital. So we went to see her. She's wonderful in that she told us, no, the tests are right. She does not have familial dysautonomia, but she has something called mitochondrial disease. And I remember that day very, very specific. Because I was like, what? Can you say that again? How do you spell that? I had no idea. I was like, wait, Mito what? And I Mito what? And I'm like, what's this word? And I went home, and of course, I, you know, looked it up on the computer, and I was really lost in this scientific blurb of science I didn't understand. And by the grace of the universe, I ended up being connected to somebody online that lived in Philadelphia that told us to go see Dr. Mark Corson, who was one of the Mito experts. And he had a Mito clinic in Boston at Tufts at Floating Children's Hospital. We got sent to him, and he diagnosed Rena with mitochondrial disease. And I want to just hook back up with when we were at CHOP, and all the local doctors, you know, as wonderful as they were, we were all out of their wheelhouse, and nobody was giving us answers, and no one was really taking it as serious as it needed to be. And we were confirmed with that and validated with Dr. Axelrod said to us, because most of Rena's issues were autonomic and very significant blood pressure issues and very significant heart rate issues. And she very bluntly said to us, this is not familial dysautonomia, but someone needs to take this seriously. And if someone doesn't take this seriously, it's a life-threatening situation. And she really put that very to our pediatrician also. And so they realized that we had to take this seriously, the significance of it. We saw Dr. Corson, and we asked his prognosis, and I'll let Ari tell what he said about the prognosis.
So, well, and actually quickly before the prognosis, just a little bit of mito community history. While now CHOP has a phenomenal, you know, center for mitochondrial research, this was before that existed. And
so this was in about 2004.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. And it's amazing. And so it's been, what, 18 years?
Yes.
How things have changed significantly in that time.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, Dr. Corson, you know, said to us that he would not actually give a prognosis, but he said that the reason is because the nature of mitochondrial disease is such that he's been wrong on both ends of the spectrum more times, which is there were some patients that he would have sworn, you know, would be doing terrific for a very long time. And then something came up and then all of a sudden, unfortunately, head in the wrong direction, and vice versa. Other patients that he was positive that the appointment was the last time he'd ever see them. And then years and years and years later, you know, he was still treating them. So he did not want to give us a prognosis at that point because of the unknown course of mitochondrial disease.
And he was very clear to us. What he said to us was, there's always hope. And even at that time, he said, there's always hope. And mitochondrial disease can be a progressive disease with an unknown path. And he said, I learned the most from my patient. I've stopped giving prognosis because there was a patient that when she was a toddler, when I was young, and he said, when I was just beginning as a doctor and expert in the field, I gave them a prognosis that she wasn't going to have a long lifespan. And now she is a college graduate with a black belt in karate. And so from that, he learned. Right. And so he was learning, and that was a really very important thing. You know, he said people, and he said, anyone who gives him a prognosis about mitochondrial disease doesn't understand what mitochondrial disease is and doesn't understand about it. And he was really clear about that. And that was very, very important to us. And I think something important for us that when we talk to other parents, that is, you know, it's not a terminal illness. It's not a fatal illness. It's not under that category. It's of an unknown path, which makes it very, very challenging, very difficult. So when we first saw Dr. Corson, you know, except for these weird things that were happening, you know, at that point when she was about almost 10 years old, she still was, you know, from the outside looked like a typical kid, you know, and was in school full time. It didn't really have any issues, you know, and so. And he had talked to us about hydration, that hydration was really important. And he talked about the fat, you know, she ate regular, drank regular, but he talked about the level of hydration that they needed. And he talked to us about considering a feeding tube for hydration because the amount of liquid that she needed to have in her system for her autonomic system to work appropriately was beyond what she could manage. And simply remember, we drove home, you know, from Massachusetts to Philadelphia, all those hours, and we're thinking, a feeding tube, that's like really, you know, that's so significant. And we kind of were not blowing it off, but, you know, really thought it was pretty an extreme thing to think about. And as we're thinking about that, so we went home thinking about it and remembering he's saying, you know, we don't know what this prognosis, and, you know, she was, you know, came into his office, you know, running into his office, like looking like a regular kid. A week and a half after that appointment, she said to me, I don't feel good. I'm tired. I want to go lie down. I said, sure, go take a nap, you know, whatever. She was 8 years old. I was like, okay, whatever. And she woke up and she said to me, you know, something's wrong. And she lost her ability to drink. She couldn't drink any. She told me she just couldn't drink. I was like, what's wrong? She's like, she just couldn't swallow. She couldn't drink. It wouldn't go down. Same thing with food. And her blood pressure was dangerously low. We're talking about 50 over 20. She looked at a piece of paper and she was a kid who was completely literate, cognitively completely okay, wasn't able to read words on the page. She couldn't read. She lost her ability to read. And we contacted, her doctors who didn't know what was going on. And it turned out that was a metabolic stroke that happened. And we ended up in the hospital, originally, obviously, in the hospital. And it was a really very challenging stay because no one knew what to do. And her blood pressures were really, really significant. It was the first time, they would be dipping down to 50s over 20s, and they were running in and trying to help with fluids, and things weren't working. And luckily, we had just seen Mark Horson, and we contacted him, and he said, and he talked to, he was incredibly giving of his time and guided that team as to what to do for her in that visit and what to do. And what ended up happening was that during that stay, because of what happened, she ended up getting an NG tube and then a feeding tube. And that was the beginning of her difficulties.
Yeah, so that was really a turning point for you in her journey.
Yes.
Can we go back to the diagnosis piece? Because I know, even though we're, many years later, the diagnosis journey for most patients is really one of the most challenging. And for you, it sounds like for Rena, you were very fortunate to be in an environment where you had doctors that were that were fortunate to consider all options, right? They weren't putting you in a box or saying, this doesn't fit this mold, and so we just don't know what it is. That they were consistent and continuing to look and pushing you to other doctors where they felt you could find answers.
Actually, not.
No.
Okay. I'm going to say not. We had an amazing, amazing pediatrician, And I think the key is you need to have one person that you trust in your corner. And it doesn't matter who that doctor is, but one person. And we had this one pediatrician who was amazing, who was the person that was willing to step out of the box. At that time, all of her specials were at CHOP, and they were kept on putting her in this box, right? In this box that wasn't fitting. And they were dismissing everything that we were saying, and that we were incredibly, incredibly frustrated and scared, and we didn't know what to do. And we just didn't know what to do. One of the doctors at CHOP said to us, one thing she was having right after we saw Dr. Axelrod at NYU, it was a summertime, and we were outside for like 5 minutes, and she got overheated really quickly, by the heat. And she came home and she couldn't stand, she couldn't walk, nothing, she couldn't do anything. And I contacted this doctor who we had seen at CHOP, and he said to us, heat intolerance doesn't happen in mitochondrial disease. So it can't be mitochondrial disease. This was after we saw Dr. Axelrod. He said it couldn't be mitochondrial disease because, heat intolerance doesn't happen in mitochondrial disease. And again, I looked up on UMDF's website, and I was like, oh, look, it says, that was like one of the main things. And I questioned it. And he said, again, we were in this box, and he told us that he never seen a patient with anything like this that happened, and just to go home and just to enjoy being with her. And there was really nothing wrong. And I contacted our pediatrician, because Rena was so sick. And, this was before we saw Mark Horson, and Rena was so sick, and I didn't know what to do. She couldn't get up from it being hot outside. And here was this doctor telling me not to worry about it. And she said to me, I'll never forget, she said to us, when you get to the point that, and you're in the best hospital, one of the number one hospitals in the world, children's hospital in the world, and they don't have answers for you, and they're dismissing you, it's time to look elsewhere.
Right. That's good advice. Yes.
And thank God for her and her boldness and her moxie and being able to push us beyond the limits to support us and give us the strength to go beyond the number one children's hospital in the country and look elsewhere.
Yeah. So having gone through that situation and now being on this side of things, what would be your advice to new parents who are just starting this journey, who might be struggling with the challenges of diagnosis or being in a physician's office where they're not hearing them? And, you know, what would be your advice to those families in advocating for themselves and their child?
I think it's a couple things. You know, first, you know, there is a fine line between, you know, Googling things and learning on your own, and then thinking that because you've Googled that you know better than the doctor. But on the other hand, listen, there are, Lord knows, thousands, tens of thousands of different medical issues. Every doctor cannot be an expert on every medical issue. And if you really feel like the doctor you're talking to is not acknowledging, or as we said in our case, even saying something that appeared to be at odds with what the expert organization about the disease said was common knowledge, look elsewhere. You know, we always said, you know, and again, thank God, you know, things have done a total turnaround in terms of mitochondrial disease at CHOP. But, you know, CHOP has always been a phenomenal hospital. And we were just frustrated that they weren't willing to admit we can't be number one in knowledge of every single thing. Certainly a lot of our friends, too, were like, really? You're not going to CHOP? Aren't they the best hospital? And we'd be like, yeah, they are a great hospital. But at that point in time, not for this. So you really got to kind of, you know, have some self-fortitude and stick to your guns.
And one thing that we have learned on a journey through the time, because what happened was we ended up building a team for ourselves of doctors in different hospitals. And, you know, what we've learned from other families across the country through the Mito community is that our advice is for people that, you know, everyone runs to the big hospitals. Everyone runs to the big hospital. And that isn't always the best place to be because big hospitals are really great for the big diseases that are well known and are cut and dry and black and white. Often they are not good for complex cases where there isn't a roadmap, and you really need to be open and listen to different doctors and listen to professionals and also listen to the parent. So our advice is when finding someone to follow your gut and think about if, you know, to find a doctor or a team of doctors that are willing to listen, that are willing to be open, that put ego aside and is really parent-driven and individual child-driven.
Right, right. So having a champion on your medical team is a really important piece of it. And, you know, so many of our families aren't in a place where they have access to one of the larger medical centers. And so that doesn't necessarily mean that they won't be able to get the same high quality of care if they're not able to get to the major medical centers, but not that they can't consult with the major medical centers as part of their team. So tell us, so you had this turning point in Rena's journey, and then kind of what did that look like going forward? What was life like for you going forward?
It quickly changed, and everything was, like you said, a very huge turning point, right? Because she was this regular kid going to school, and all of a sudden, like, now we know, you know, which we didn't know then. Now we know very often, you know, she was about 10 years old. For many kids with mitochondrial disease, that is a time that things can go awry. And that's really what happened for Rena. And so she went from being, you know, everyday school to suddenly being so sick that she really was hardly in school, and she got first, you know, so the first thing was that happened was that what was happening was about every 2-3 weeks, her blood pressure and her heart rates got so dangerously low that we were urgently sent to the ICU to manage her her issues. And again, we had this pediatrician who was really, really in our corner, who said to us, we need to find somebody, an expert locally, who can manage this. And she had, thank goodness, found a cardiologist at St. Christopher Hospital, which is a tiny hospital in Philadelphia. And so we went there, and Marina was starting to get treated there for those episodes. And she'd be getting fluids, IV fluids, for about every 2-3 weeks. And so basically our lives turned into being in the hospital for 6 days every 3 weeks. And a doctor came up to us at the hospital and from the palliative care team and said to us, you know, this isn't a way for you to live, you know. And they were being very honest, and we really appreciated it very, very much. And we and then talked about other options. And so the first thing they did was try to besides a G-tube, the next step was try to put in a J-tube, a separate J-tube, to get more fluids. So then that was the first thing that we did, and we got a J-tube. And so she had both running. So 24 hours a day, she was getting fluids. And they were thinking very, very out of the box. These were people who thought completely out of the box. And they were taking IV fluids and putting them into her J-tube, which goes through the intestine, and trying to avoid having a port for her. And we did that, and unfortunately, it did not help her enough. And pretty quickly after that, she needed to have a port inserted to have IV fluids running. So basically turned into 24/7 her having fluids in order for her to be able to live and to be able to be at home. So that was our next step. Now, and with that, we had this amazing cardiologist who sort of became the champion on the team and the leader of the team with Dr. Corson. Because for Rena, what happened was, what we learned was that like the numbers that would send people to the ER were her blood pressure and heart rate numbers, were for Rena everyday numbers. So that was something that we had to learn to deal with, you know. And again, that was something that was very challenging, because our pediatrician, actually, who was wonderful, was scared out of her wits and wanted to send us to the hospital every time. And luckily we had, you know, Dr. Corson and this cardiologist who stood up, you know, sort of to her and said, no, you can do this at home.
Well, and understanding what her baseline was, right? Her baseline was very different than what a child who's not impacted by mitochondrial disease is, and learning to balance that and understanding when is a crisis that you can't handle at home, but not being terrified when those numbers reach a level that's not typical. But for Rena, it was typical.
Exactly. And actually, to be clear, too, I mean, at that point, Rena was still going to school, but she had a nurse with her. But again, the energy crashes became much more frequent. And, you know, eventually, you know, we had to just keep her home and have home instruction, because psychologically, for her to feel that she had a classroom at school that she was never in because she was always so sick, it was better for her to just kind of feel that, you know, she was having a new style of education at home with the home instruction.
Right. How old was she when you had to make that change?
She was sixth grade.
Yeah. Middle school. Yeah. Which is, you know, socialization is a big issue and things like that. And that makes complete sense, right? As you said, Ari, it's going from an environment where she didn't feel like she was being successful because she wasn't in the classroom, but being able to adjust what her school environment looked like so she could be in a different environment, but yet still have success.
Right. And in another example, too, of how the world has changed so much was, you know, there was some discussion at that point of maybe electronically being able to hook her into the classroom. And everyone was like, oh, no, you can't do that. There are privacy issues.
What a novel idea.
Now it would be, if you know, a no-brainer.
Right.
The other major, major turning point in 2009, in January of 2009, she suddenly couldn't walk. And we didn't know what was going on. And again, we had this amazing neurologist at St. Christopher Hospital for Children, Joe Melvin, who was just amazing. And he said to us, oh, you know, there's this, he told us what it was. It was a virus in the legs. And he said, it's going around right now. We'll go into the ICU. We'll give her antibiotics. And in a few days, she'll get better. And one of the markers of mitochondrial disease very often, which is that a stress to the body or an illness will cause a skill, you know, a child to lose a skill or and not be able to regain that skill. And he told us that there was this huge amount of kids in the hospital at that point. And he said, with this illness and virus in the legs, and he said, we'll give her antibiotics, in 3 days she'll be fine. And she never was able to walk again or stand again. And he told us,
independently.
And so she was born in 1995. So this was 2009. And he later told us the truth, because he always wanted to have hope for us, and he didn't know what was going to happen. And so he didn't tell us then what his thought was, but he said, you know, he just thought, okay, things are going to get better. And they kept on telling us, you know, it can get better. And, but he sort of knew that that could be, you know, he sort of saw that as a turning point. And we started on this roller coaster of, downslopes of very serious crises going on, and then things would get better, and then crises. And we were lucky if at that point we were, not in the hospital. You know, if a month went by and we weren't in the hospital, we were like happy, you know, that was really what life became for us. And so all of a sudden she lost her ability to walk, right? And then right after that, that was January of that year. And in March, remember, we then had nursing at home because once she got a port, we needed nursing at home because she was getting fluids from, you know, a G-tube, a J-tube, a port 24/7. And she and her care was really, every hour we were doing something. And so the nurses said, you know, I would wake up, and we had night nursing only at that point. And I would go in the morning, and the nurse one day, the nurse said to us, I don't know what happened, but her breathing, I can't get her breathing under control. And I thought it was pneumonia. And we went to the hospital, and we had an amazing pulmonary, thank goodness again, that this little tiny hospital in Philadelphia had this amazing team, and this amazing pulmonologist told us, you know, think it's pneumonia, we'll just treat it. She'll go on the Cadillac of ventilators, and we'll give her a few days and she'll get better. And she didn't get better. And she was someone who thought completely out of the box, really, really out of the box. And she told us that she was going to treat her like a patient with muscular dystrophy. And she was going to hook up this ventilator and make it seem like it was a ventilator, but using a CPAP machine, and that we would use it a few hours a day. And so she did that, and we went home with that, with a whole new set of equipment, again, learning her equip. And she did that. And what quickly happened was, again, it wasn't enough for her. And very quickly, she needed to be on with the CPAP on that mask on her face 24 hours a day, except for when she was eating, which was really, really super challenging. And it came to a point within a few months that wasn't enough. Her lungs were not working on her own at all. And she, they tried it. They gave it their best try. And she felt like she couldn't make the decision on her own. So she sent us back to, said, you know, I need Dr. Corson to tell me, to give me guidance. And he very frankly told us that her respiratory system was not going to recover. And she was 13, and she got a trach and became vent dependent 24/7. And the vent was breathing for her on her. And she never breathed on her own again. And at that point, again, things switched in ways that we never, ever, ever saw. Her respiratory issues became her biggest, you know, one of her biggest issues, along with her heart rate and her blood pressures.
So even throughout all of these incredible challenges that you guys were facing, something incredible was brewing. talk to us about Rena's interests and how she began to write the script for what became the Magic Bracelet.
Yeah, so I had a colleague at Gratz College, where I worked at the time, who, interestingly, he was in the IT department, but he also had a drama background and was trying to kind of get into the world of theater. And so he was very close to us. And matter of fact, when Rena was still able to get out of the house, she would come to my office and he would give her little tasks here and there on the computer to help do. And so when she was homebound, just as a total distraction, he says to her, "You know, I'm trying to start this new theater company. And one of the things that I'm going to need are ideas for new productions. So maybe you can, you know, come up with some ideas for some
for a
film." And, you know, Rena took this very seriously and very quickly came up with a film concept. And so she emailed it back to him and he's like, "Okay, that sounds like a good idea. Now here's the next thing that you have to do, which is you create a log line." And the log line is when you, see a movie trailer and there's that usually guy with the deep voice in the background, you know, giving the summary of the movie. That's the log line. So Rena works on a log line and literally just within a few hours sends him back a log line. So he responds back. He's like, "This is unbelievable." He says, "I'm really not doing this just to be nice. But, you know, experts work on log lines for, you know, days and days trying to get a good log line. And Rena just came up with a great log line in a couple hours."
And, you know, and so the piece is that, you know, she always was this creative kid and had this moxie in her of, you know, like almost like a director. Her, you know, neurologist would joke that she always was directing. In fact, you know, when she was so sick in the hospital these times, she would be trying to negotiate her way out of getting out of the hospital. And he would say, you know, he would come in and say, "Okay, this is how you're doing today. And I'll come back in, you know, tomorrow and see how you're doing. We could talk about getting discharged." And she would say, "How about 6 hours?" And she would even negotiate that. And she was always, you know, like this little director. That was just her personality. You know, and because she became at that point, because of mitochondrial disease, she became, you know, pop culture was her way to connect to the world, right? And so she, at a very, very young age, realized the power of film. And she would get really, really, really annoyed that these big disease names got all this attention and a lot of positive attention. And she was like, "Okay, I have mitochondrial disease and nobody's talking about it. And so she decided, she's like, we need to get attention. We need to have and she's like, "I'm going to write a film and it's going to be in Hollywood and it's going to have this big cast and it's going to have this, as big of a voice as all these other big, you know, diseases have. And that's what I need to do." Because her dream, all of a sudden she had this dream and she said, "You know, I'm going to write this script of this movie film and with all these Hollywood people, and it's going to be on the big screen and people are going to walk out of the theater and say, and won't go home and Google mitochondrial disease." But yet again, with her attitude, she said, she would say, "I don't want a St. Jude's commercial. I don't want it's not going to be sad. I want a funny, happy, fun adventure film that happens to have a character with mitochondrial disease, and so people will learn about it in that way."
How long did it take her to write the script?
So what happened was that she, you know, so she with Mitch, with this colleague, they would have these weekly phone meetings. And remember, she was so sick often, you know, this was happening often in the hospital and other times, but she was adamant about them happening, and they would have these weekly meetings. And at that point, she was so sick that the adults recognized how sick she was. And so they sort of pushed things forward. But she was, so she would come up with ideas and he would write it into a movie-esque type of way, you know, like the script. But it was all her concepts. And so that process we got.
Well, and then he would email back the script for us to read to her. And then she would give him comments back. I like this. I don't like that.
And it took, it was about a year process. And we fast forwarded because she was so sick.
Yeah. So in true director fashion, so as she was working on the script, did she give you direction as to what she wanted to see happen next and where she wanted it to go?
Absolutely. Like there's a shaman in the film, and she talked about that, and that was the person with the magic that was going to cure mitochondrial disease, that had a cure for mitochondrial disease possibly, and it was this magical thing, and he made it sort of the scary person. And she said she had this vision that she wanted the film to be this family film, and she wanted to be a G-rated film and a Disney-esque rated film. And she said right away to him, no, you know, you got it wrong. Like, that's wrong. I, you know, that guy is, he's too dark. He's too scary. I told you I wanted a G-rated film. Redo the character.
Right. And then, okay, so let's fast forward and tell me how, you know, Rena worked so hard on getting this script pulled together and everybody jumped in to support her. How were things going with her physically? How was her disease progressing and how was she doing?
Yeah, so that's kind of the irony is that, you know, she is getting increasingly weak and sick through this whole process. But as Stacy just said, I mean, even when we were inpatient in the hospital, that was not an excuse not to have the weekly check-in with Mitch. That was an important part of the day. Later on, actually, afterwards, her hospice nurse commented looking back and saying, you know, I would see Rena talking about this film and working on this film. And she said, I would look at Rena and I was like, how is this girl doing it? She has no energy. She is just barely able to stay awake. But when it came to the film, she willed herself to be able to, you know, get the energy and to do what she had to do.
Yeah, she was on a mission.
You know, so fast forward, we really realized at time that it became for her, you know, she wasn't going to have a lot of time left on the earth, you know, and we really, really wanted her to see this film be what she wanted to be. So what we arranged a read through for her of the script. And again, they wanted this whole, you know, thing to sort of happen this whole day. And we recognized that she only had the energy for people to be in our house for 45 minutes. So we read we did the last scene of the film so that she was able to sit on the couch as a director and direct this, you know, her script. And he got a bunch of just local people to do this little read through for her. And then Rena went on hospice in September of 2010. The hospice nurse, who's amazing, you know, helped her talk about what was important to her. And she asked me to promise to take care of her film because she wanted to be in Hollywood. And we realized at that time that she was not going to see it happen, that she wasn't going to see it on the screen. And when she said, promise to take care of my film, she meant, you know, make it happen and make, you know, make it in Hollywood in the way that she wanted. And one thing that we did do for her before she died in December of 2010, we sent her script off to a Hollywood producer who we knew that wasn't going to take it on, but that gave her, it finished it for her because her script was finished. Her name was on it and it got sent out to Hollywood, and we actually registered her, which she saw as in the Writers Guild of America.
Amazing. Just amazing. Well, you guys have done an amazing job of taking care of her film. There's no doubt about it. So you got it in the hands of an organization that agreed to help you make her dream come to life. Tell us what that was all about?
We were told by a friend who also suffers from mitochondrial disease. And she's like, you know, I was Googling around and I found this organization called Make-A-Film Foundation. And it says that they make films for kids who have life-limiting illnesses. So we reached out to them totally blindly. And, you know, they were very touched by the story. But initially, they actually turned us down and said, you know, we work with children that are still alive so that they can see their film legacy, you know, come to fruition. And unfortunately, Rena's no longer with us. But Stacy was very persistent and also explained and said, you know, this script was Rena's. You know, this is not us trying to what's the word I'm looking for?
It wasn't about you guys. It was about honoring her legacy and her wishes.
Exactly. Thank you. And so Tamika Lamison, who was the executive director of the Make-A-Film Foundation, was so struck by the whole story that she, at that point, reconsidered and took the film on as a project.
In December of 2012, her film was produced in LA and in Hollywood, and it was directed, and the film is called The Magic Bracelet. It was directed by John Paul, who is now known for doing most recently Bombshell and Greatest Showman. Those are his recent things, but he has a very, very long cachet of, you know, incredible things. Very, very well-known director in Hollywood. And in the Hollywood world, once a director comes up, when you ask actors and other people to come on, they say, who's directing it? So when they said he was directing it, the next step was Diablo Cody adapt her script to make it into this short film. And then once she came on, people said, you know, the casting director, you know, and through Make-A-Film, these are all people, they volunteer their time. It's sort of like Make-A-Wish in the film world. And the casting director put together this incredible cast who is.
So it's J.K. Simmons and Haley Steinfeld and Bailey Madison and James Vanderbeek. Also, Jackson Rathbone, whose name isn't necessarily quite as well known, but he was actually very big at the time because he had played Jasper in the Twilight movies, which was appropriate because Rena was a huge Twilight fan. And Caitlin Doubleday, who subsequently became well known in Empire TV show and actually is now in a lot of Hallmark movies too.
But, you know, and these are all people who, you know, including Diablo Cody and J.K. Simmons, who have, you know, won Oscars for their work in their field. So we're talking about people who, you know, major, major film stars.
Right. Well, she said she was going to Hollywood, right?
Right.
So you have to have the best of the best at the table for her. And that's exactly what happened, which is amazing. So how long did it take for them to, from the time that they agreed to do the film until it was actually ready to be seen by the public?
So that started in 2011, and May in 2013, it was premiered in Hollywood just as she envisioned, completely as she envisioned. And that's what Make-A-Film does. They do it as the kid wanted. And so red carpet in a very famous theater in Los Angeles. That was the premiere. The film journey continues to be completely majestic and bigger than any of us thought, but perhaps Rena knew that it was going to be this big. You know, and at this point, that was May 2013. And at this point, it's been in
Over 50 film festivals around the world, literally. It's won best film at a number of different film festivals, as well as other different awards at some different film festivals. We've screened the movie at some medical conferences.
So it's been in 80 plus screenings at this point, and the only continent in the world that has not been in is Antarctica.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, and you know, all the awards and the screenings and all of that are amazing. But having seen the film several times, what's most remarkable is the impact. And exactly what you said is how you walk away feeling and feeling inspired by Rena and her message. And as you said, she had Mito. Mito didn't have her. And that comes across very clearly in this film.
You know, she had seen, there was one documentary about a couple of girls who had mitochondrial disease. And it was a very depressing, sad, woe is me type thing. And Rena saw it and did not like it at all because she did not want the feel sorry for me attitude. She did desperately want to make sure to create awareness. That there was no doubt about. But as Stacey said, she wanted, you know, this fun type of film where people would learn about the disease as part of the script of the film. And yes, indeed, that's what's been accomplished. And I will say also, you know, medical truth and authenticity was key to her. So, you know, in the end, there is no cure found for the disease because, unfortunately, as we all know, there still is no cure. But the movie doesn't have a sad ending despite that fact. But it was very important that we had that line in the movie that says there's still no cure for mitochondrial disease. And our greatest wish would be that, frankly, that this movie would stop needing to be shown because it wouldn't be true anymore. But we're not there yet.
And, you know, in the film, yeah, the film is, it's not a, it's her film, The Magic Bracelet. It's not a documentary. It's a narrative film, you know, a fun fictional film. And it's like, as she wanted, it's this Disney-esque, fun, witty film about sisterhood and about hope and about love. And it's an adventure film. It's like a basically a Disney movie, which is what she wanted. And because people think it's about her, it's not about her. It's, you know, it's this fun film where this, what she wanted, this character happened to have mitochondrial disease. But what it's done is, you know, so we're talking about every continent, except for Antarctica. Every time we show the film and we're in the film world, we're talking about being in the Hollywood film world. It's what she wanted, because every time it's shown, people walk in because they're a fan of Bailey Madison, because they're a fan of J.K. Simmons, because they love film, and they walk out learning about mitochondrial disease.
Right. It's about the awareness, as you said, right? Being entertained, but yet getting the message and the awareness about mitochondrial disease. So now that you have had all of this incredible success getting Rena's movie to the big screen, what do you think she would be most proud of?
I mean, there's so many different pieces to it.
The two things she'd be most proud of, I think the fact that this incredible cast, right, in Hollywood, that it was what she wanted, right? Like it unfolded exactly as she has envisioned, you know, all the way. What the movie is this huge voice in Hollywood and, you know, talking about mitochondrial disease. You know, and I think, you know, that's what the fact that the sheer number of people that have seen this film, you know, the success, I think she would be, you know, the thing to be most proud of. And the fact that there were adults along the way that listened to her and didn't dismiss her and didn't, you know, because she got lots of no, you know, lots of no's, that's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And that with our persistence, you know, and her, with truly in her spirit and intention, it's nothing about us. It's all about her. That, you know, it happened in the way that she wanted it to happen.
I love that. It was how she wanted it to happen, which was amazing. What is it that you want people, the community, to know most about Rena?
Well, you know, one thing that we often say is, you know, we talk about how amazing Rena was. Listen, I mean, she was a regular kid. And, you know, so in that regard, she wasn't special. You know, she had her good days. She had her bad days. You know, she could have a tantrum just like anyone else. But on the other hand, the entire be positive philosophy that she lived by, that was 100% her and 100% authentic. And, you know, as I talk to, you know, other Mito families and other Mito parents, and, you know, we really try and accentuate, you know, her be positive message and to to tell parents about the importance of, you know, supporting their kids and their dreams and their wishes, you know, because of our experience with Rena and how much we saw that it, talk about quality of life, that it just gave her a phenomenal quality of life.
Peter Samuelson, who's a famous producer, and he was at the premiere of the film, you know, when he spoke about Rena at the premiere, he said something that was so significant. And I think it's about like what represents Rena. And he said, it's often not about the length of your life, but the width of your life. And he said, these kids are like little Yodas. And that was Rena. You know, I think the thing that, you know, we want people to know about Rena, you know, it's not that she was so special, but, you know, there's a line that she wrote in the film that she wrote, there's something about sick kids. And her point was is that because of the disease, what she went through in 14 years of life, there are people that live to 100 that didn't go through the medical challenges that she faced. And so it's about resiliency. When she said there's something about sick kids, right? It's about, and that's what people, you know, it's these amazing, you know, some, you hear from so many different parents that these kids are incredibly, incredibly resilient and have these old souls in these very young bodies because they really know what's important, you know, in life. And really, and for Rena, what we want, you know, like, you know, today, you know, this weekend is this big football weekend. And she was this huge, became, loved watching football with her dad, you know, and she would this weekend, you know, it wouldn't be, if she was here this weekend, it would not be about, it would not matter how she physically was feeling, it would not matter, be it in the hospital, be it no matter what happened, she would have that football game on cheering and yelling and screaming for her team.
I love that. And she lived in the moment. She, you know, which is a lesson that we all can learn from, is to live in the moment and enjoy and be present, which is really, really important. Well, can you share with us, if someone is interested in watching the film, The Magic Bracelet, how do they access the film and where can they view it?
You can go to makeafilmfoundation.org. and order the DVD of the film. Although, again, you know, as our society is moving away from DVDs, we don't have as many of them as we had. We're working with the foundation right now on trying to figure out a long-term solution in terms of online streaming. People can always email us at stacy@renasmovie.com, and we can make arrangements for them to be able to get a password protected a link to see the movie via streaming,
and or also the film is, the Facebook page is Rena's Magic Bracelet Movie, and they could also private message us at any time about arranging to see it digitally.
Yeah. And Mito Action, we love to have, you know, any opportunity that we have to partner with you to show the film and share Rena's story. You know that we are always committed to doing that. So we'll have some conversations and see if we can maybe try to make that happen in 2022. I think we could all use some uplifting and some of Rena's light. It's been a rough couple of years, so we could all use it.
Yeah, well, you know, when we started the very beginning of this pandemic, that was actually the first time that we offered some free online streaming of it, because we felt that everyone was home, was, you know, trying to figure out how to deal with the pandemic, and in particular kids who, the message of the film really seemed to particularly resonate at that point in time, beyond just the mitochondrial disease, but the, you know, be positive, and, you know, there's plenty to be happy about.
Yeah. And if you'll recall when we showed it for the IMC conference 2 years ago, there was a little boy who chimed in the chat, his dad chimed in and shared with us how excited he was because it was the first time he had ever seen anyone else who had mitochondrial disease. And what, I mean, obviously you don't want to know anybody who has mitochondrial disease, but to know he wasn't alone and that there were other kids who were going through what he was going through. What an incredible impact that had on him. And I think he was only 6 or 7 years old. He was really little.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We've heard that, you know, so many times from Mito kids. But another actually interesting thing is it's also been very good for the siblings of Mito kids.
Absolutely.
Because the siblings, sometimes they don't know how to talk to their friends about what's going on with their sibling. I mean, who wants to say to their buddies, "Hey, do you want to sit down? Can I tell you about this disease that my brother or sister is dealing with?"
Right.
But when you've got a movie like this and they can invite their friends over for movie night, and then that opens up the conversation for them to talk about it.
Exactly. No, absolutely. It's had a tremendous impact on our community. And we are so thankful that you took such good care of her movie and shared not only the movie, but more importantly, that you've shared Reno with us.
And the last thing that I just want to say is the reason we're doing this is because that first visit that we, when we went to Dr. Corson, his nurse at that time, who was one of the founding members of Mito Action, told us about Mito Action. And, we immediately became involved, and Mito Action became Rena's family. And through that, we found support, and she found friendships, lifelong friendships of people who were like her. And that was what carried her through, and it carried us. And we have always been so grateful to Mito Action because it wasn't about research, but about, you know, just holding each other up and supporting each other through the times. And that's one thing, you know, that, you know, Mito Action, Rena would always want to, every time there was a t-shirt or sweatshirt from Mito Action, she made us buy not one, but one for her and one for the two of us. And she would want us to wear the shirts. And what she would say is, "Represent," when I'd walk out of the house.
I love that.
Wear your shirt, represent. What did that mean? It was mean, here's your opportunity to walk out the door and tell people about mitochondrial disease.
Right, absolutely.
And so we want to, you know, thank you, Kara, for, you know, all that you continue to do for what Mito Action continues to do for the Mito world, because I think that's the, you know, last thing that we want to say is that the, you know, beyond the, with the diagnosis, the most important thing is, you know, not to walk the path alone and to create a village for yourself. And now at this point, Mito Action has so many different opportunities to be able to support to be held up and to be supported.
Yeah. Well, family is forever. And I know I've told you that before, and Mito Action will always be family to you. I will always be family to you. And I look forward to continuing to share Rena with the world and her movie and her incredible message of hope and positivity. So thank you both so much for being here with us today. And again, we will put in the show notes the links to their website and Facebook page so that if you're interested in watching the movie, you'll be able to do so. And you can always find information about Rena and the Magic Bracelet on the Mito Action website. And stay tuned for opportunities where we'll be partnering with the Goldbergs to show the movie and share Rena's spirit and light with everyone. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Energy in Action. Remember to give us a 5-star rating on your listening app. This helps to boost us up the charts and makes it easier for others to find us. You can find all of the links and details that we share today in the show notes or at mitoaction.org. Have a great day, and we look forward to having you join us next time.